Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by the Lansing State Journal, offering up-to-date news and information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, on your phone, your tablet, and online at lsj.com.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR today. Politico tweets what Michael Moore and Glenn Beck have in common. This doesn't happen often. It's high praise for Edward Snowden, the 29-year-old NSA whistleblower. Michael Moore calls Snowden the hero of the year. Glenn Beck tweets, courage, finally. Real, thoughtful, transparent, willing to accept the consequences. Inspire with malice toward none. 8th District Congressman Mike Rogers told ABC This Week yesterday that Snowden should be prosecuted. He also commented last week that the NSA surveillance program was responsible for solving a serious security threat in recent years. Snowden right now is apparently seeking asylum in Hong Kong, and it's interesting now to watch offers of asylum unfold. There is talk that at least one elected official in Iceland has brought up the subject of offering Snowden asylum. Make of that what you will. We have an interesting show here for you today. We talk with violinist Catherine Vodopek coming up a little bit. We talk with an expert on exporting and how we can beef up Michigan exports here for our economy. At the top today, regionalism is a buzzword that's uttered throughout metropolitan communities across the country, and mid-Michigan is no exception. Proponents say it's more than a lofty ideal whereby the assets and resources of large cities benefit the surrounding suburbs. In hard economic times, they claim regionalism is a lifeline for survival. Now, today, the cities of Lansing and East Lansing are announcing a collaboration with four outlying townships to share fire protection services. Their decision to enter into three new agreements is based on a 2012 study funded in part by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce. Those six municipalities will formally announce their plan today. Joining me now to talk about this alliance is East Lansing City Clerk Marie McKenna, who's at the middle of this process. Hi, Marie.
Good morning.
And the president of the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce is on the phone with us, Tim Damon. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Mark. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us. Before we look at how shared service is changing, Marie McKenna, why don't you explain to our listeners generally how services are already being shared?
Sure. There's a tremendous foundation of collaboration and training, hazmat response, purchasing, but probably the most recognized service sharing that we are currently engaged in is our shared police or fire chief, Chief Randy Talafaro, who is the shared chief between Lansing and East Lansing.
Okay. Tim Damon, what role has the chamber played in this process? You are a supporter of this trend toward regionalism, correct?
Well, you know, we have our board of directors really has identified over the last few years regionalism as one of the top priorities for our organization and how we kind of help bring together and support some of the efforts that the municipalities are undertaking. As Marie mentioned, there's been a tremendous amount of progress made in our fire and public safety areas. And 2 years ago, actually, former East Lansing City Manager Ted Staten approached the Chamber and the Lansing Economic Area Partnership about providing some private sector funding for the Shared Fire Services report. And I tell you what, we didn't hesitate. We immediately indicated that we would do that, and we had a great response from the private sector as well to provide some funding for the report.
Randy Talafaro is currently the fire chief for both the city of Lansing and the city of East Lansing. Tim, from your perspective, what impact is that having?
Well, I think, one, when that announcement was made, we said, okay, maybe most people look at that and would say, boy, yeah, they should have maybe done that 10 years ago. But we felt that that had and just set the stage for what we're going to be announcing today. to see the two cities come together and that at that point in time. And I think that that was right around the time, and maybe even before the report was made public and finished and finalized. And so we thought that that was two huge steps that are a huge step that both East Lansing and Lansing took at doing it. And I'm convinced more than ever that as a result of that, we're seeing this increased collaboration leading up to the announcements that we're going to be having later this morning.
Marie McKenna, you're the East Lansing City Clerk. How is it you've gotten so involved in this process?
Thank you. That's a great question. If I could just take a moment, I would like to recognize the Chamber and the Lansing Economic Area Partnership for sure. Their participation. They didn't hesitate to help fund the grant match. We had two individuals who served on our steering committee who continued to serve on our steering committee have been fantastic. They've also provided some communication resources for us. So I thank them for that. So as the city clerk, how am I involved in this?
Yeah.
I used to be the assistant city manager, and Chief Talafaro back in about 2.5 years ago asked me to serve as a liaison between the fire chiefs and the area managers with whom I had working relationships. So that's really how we started to begin to get everybody together. So early in 11, we convened a meeting, had a few difficult conversations, but all agreed unanimously to pursue this grant. So everything has really dovetailed nicely. The grant becoming available, the study, and then Chief Cochran retiring and Randy stepping in as the dual chief has been fantastic.
Who's driving the process exactly, though?
I would say the managers and the chiefs. And what we did probably about almost a year ago is establish a formalized committee structure that really mimics what we did during the study. So we have an executive committee that consists of the managers, the chiefs, in this case of Lansing Township, the supervisor who's a working supervisor, and myself.
And you meet regularly then?
Yes, thank you. We meet once a month. The chiefs, who form the operations committee and who really are the subject matter experts in all of this, meet twice a month. And then we try to keep our steering committee, which includes our private sector partners, MSU, and our union partners, informed on a quarterly basis.
The goal appears to be what's called automatic mutual assistance. Automatic mutual assistance. Tim Damon, do you have an idea? What does that mean to you?
Well, I tell you, and Marie can probably correct me on this, but I think that's where we would be dispatching the closest available, whether it be ambulance or truck at that point in time for an emergency. And so that's where you would potentially have,
regardless of where it's coming from, correct?
Exactly. Okay. My understanding is it would be kind of, crossing jurisdictional boundaries and really would kind of make them invisible. And so you could potentially have an East Lansing ambulance that would be making a call into the city of Lansing, or a city ambulance making a call into Delhi Township potentially. And I think that that's where the report is really kind of looking at some of the phases in phase one and phase two, is kind of getting into that automatic mutual aid. And there's already mutual aid in place today. I think this would just be taking it one step further and more of the collaboration there.
Can either of you say what is the automatic mutual aid that's in place now, Marie?
I agree with Tim's assessment. We just don't have formalized agreements to provide automatic mutual aid, but if there are events that require additional resources, they are provided across jurisdictional borders. But this makes it formalizes it. What we'll be looking at in the next month or so, mutual aid box alarm system. I can't tell you exactly what that means, but that is a protocol that provides training that will get everybody on equal footing, and it just enhances the mutual aid that we're able to provide. So over the course of the next few weeks, we'll be bringing that to our respective councils and boards for approval.
We're talking with Marie McKenna, the East Lansing City Clerk, and Tim Damon, President of the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, about today's announcement toward increased sharing of fire services here amongst six municipalities, the City of Lansing, City of East Lansing, and four outlying townships. Are rate increases or millages a part of funding this program, Marie?
They are not at this time. What we're trying to do is look at future cost containment. I don't know that that means that we're necessarily resulting in a net cutting of cost, but if we can contain our cost growth by being more efficient and continuing to look for efficiencies, that I think is the direction in which we're headed.
How much, Tim Damon, how much of this is a quality of life issue as far as the chamber is concerned?
Whether it's quality of life or, you know, I think more importantly, quality of efficiencies maybe, and that would be that I think with the issues and the budget and financial challenges that all of our municipalities are under today, I think as Marie just said, there is cost containment here. And are there ways for us to control those costs and or better yet take some cost out of the system and more efficient delivery of services? And so, you know, whether we market that as a quality of life or just sort of a cost of doing business, you know, I guess remains to be seen there, but we definitely think that it's important for our region, and as we look to grow and attract, you know, more business investment into our region, we feel that this plays a big part in it.
How much urgency, Marie, is there amongst all of these participating municipalities to move in this direction? Is there a shared urgency amongst all of them, or do some? I mean, does Lansing take it more seriously than others, for example?
Oh, that's a great question. I think everybody takes it seriously. It is evident that probably different communities are in different financial situations, but we all take this very seriously and have some urgency to it, because we're just realizing that there are better ways to do things. And I wanted to mention something that I think complements today's later announcements and what I've learned studying this process, because it's been very interesting to me and to be able to chronicle it, and I take copious notes and look back on it. The relationship and the trust building that has taken place over the last 2 years has just been astonishing. And my personal view is, as we move into more complicated or complex arrangements in terms of regionalizing the fire service, those relationships have to be in place.
Okay. We'll be watching it closely. East Lansing City Clerk Marie McKenna and Tim Damon, President of the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce. Thanks to both of you. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Current state on WKAR, the 14th Van Cliburn International Piano Competition wrapped up over the weekend in Fort Worth, Texas, with the top prize going to 26-year-old Vadim Kolodenko of Ukraine. Music lovers around here know that the winner of the very first Van Cliburn competition in 1962 was MSU College of Music professor emeritus Ralph Vodopek. He and his wife Albertine have often performed together, and they've raised a family of musicians. One of their children, Catherine Vodopek, is a violinist on the music faculty at the University of Michigan. Current state Scott Pohl recently met with Catherine Vodopek and her dad at the Cook Recital Hall in the MSU Music Building. The violinist talked about how her parents influenced her life and work.
It seemed normal to me that my parents both were pianists, and that we all took music lessons, and that we were expected to practice, and that in the summers we went to music camps, and many evenings in the week we would go to concerts, and there would be music playing on the stereo at home, and the discussion at the dinner table would often be about various piano students and concerts coming up and things like this. And now that I am no longer living with my parents, I'm married to a violinist and I have two children who take music lessons, and we go to concerts and talk about students over the dinner table, and it feels like this is just, you know, the continuum of life. I know that the majority of people out there, you know, they do different things for a living, but this has just been my life. It seems just usual and normal, and it feels especially normal that all of us were in music. We just have all done that same thing and followed that same track. I don't know if that makes us more boring, but there we are.
Being the children of pianists, did you all play piano, gravitate to these other instruments? How did that work out?
No, I really think my parents chose our instruments for us. My brother Paul started on the piano because I don't exactly remember why they started him on the piano, but I think fairly early on they realized that he didn't like to be the third pianist in the household. And it was too much pressure having them be his parents. And he wanted to play a wind instrument, and you can't start a wind instrument quite so early as a string instrument. So he moved to the clarinet as soon as he was able to. And I don't remember choosing the violin. I think my parents loved string instruments and wanted us to have our own voice and not just to be more pianists. Thank goodness. Otherwise, we would have had to fight over whose turn it was to practice on the piano.
And how many pianos you have to practice on.
Right. Well, we have two, but they're both in the same room. So, you know, if two people want to practice at the same time, you're out of luck.
Do you think they had designs on a family combo? I know
no,
that you've performed no. with your siblings and your dad quite extensively.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't think that they had any idea that we had to be professional musicians. In fact, they both said they didn't have any designs on us growing up to be professional musicians. And I think they were surprised, frankly, when we all sort of made our announcements at various points that we wanted to major in music and go on in music. They just loved music so much, they wanted us to have that as part of our lives. And I feel the same way with my own children. I say to people, I don't necessarily want them to be musicians, but it makes me very happy that they take their music seriously and that they're good at what they do. And if they want to be musicians, that would make me happy as well.
You've chosen an academic career path like your father. You're at the University of Michigan. What appeals to you about teaching and working with college students?
So many things. Well, first of all, you know, it's great to be associated with the university, to have that stability and to know that you go into work and that you have all these colleagues. Concertizing, when I was in the Chester Quartet for all those years with my husband, it's a different mindset thinking about concerts and preparing for concerts. The preparation and the playing concerts is always fun, but the traveling is kind of a drag, and worrying about keeping the schedule and dealing with managers and what's the season looking like and what kind of interesting gimmick do we have to make our next season sound especially interesting. That kind of stuff is wearisome. It's nice to go into the university and to have these students who are eager to learn and know that they're the next generation of musicians, and just to share with them what you love about music and help them hopefully to become better musicians themselves.
Can you tell me about your background away from the house?
Yes. Well, I didn't go to East Lansing High. I went to Lansing Catholic Central, and they didn't have much of a music program, so even though that was a good school in many ways, I wouldn't say I got any musical inspiration there. But my teachers, every step of the way, I feel very grateful to my parents. They sort of handpicked the very best teachers for me. And they've all been a huge inspiration to me, and I couldn't be more grateful to all of them. They started me with Lyman Bodman, who was a retired viola professor here at Michigan State. He was wonderful. He set up so many violin and viola students so well. I got my foundations from him, and then I studied with Romeo Tada, another retired violin professor at State, and he was wonderful for my growth. He was such a kind person and helped me through difficulties that I was having with my technique when I was in junior high. And then when I was in high school, my parents would make the drive down to Ann Arbor on Saturday mornings. I studied with Angel Reyes, and he took my playing up to a whole new level. He didn't accept anything less than 4 hours of practicing a day and all the hardest music, and he just made me realize, like, wow, this isn't just, you know, an after-school activity. This is serious business, playing the violin. And then I went to Interlochen during the summers. That was a huge inspiration to realize that there were all these students my age out there who were so serious about their music. I felt very alone in a certain way growing up, like there weren't so many serious violinists around me, maybe because I went to a private school. But Interlochen really opened my eyes that there were all these people out there. There's a whole world, a musical world, that wasn't last name of Vodopek. And then college, I studied with Franco Gulli at Indiana University. He was the most magnificent violinist and musician and person. I learned so much from him. And then at Juilliard, I studied with Robert Mann and of the Juilliard Quartet. And what can you say about Robert Mann except that every lesson was an eye-opening experience. And to this day, there's so many things that I think about and feel about music that I learned from him. I just owe such a debt of gratitude to all of these teachers.
When we started setting up this interview, I asked you if you would play for me. And so I want to ask you about the piece you selected. And it was interesting that you approached me about, can we can we record with an accompanist? Well, sure. And it turned out to be that you wanted to play with your father. So tell me what you were thinking when I asked you to play for me, why you chose the piece you chose.
Well, because I like it. We performed this Grieg sonata together, my dad and I, last school year. And I think of the three Grieg sonatas, it's the least often played. I mean, everybody plays the third sonata. That's a staple of the violin repertoire. But the first two sonatas, not so much. And this second sonata in G major, I think it's just a real gem. It's very almost simple and naive, sweet, full of folksy elements, but just well written and showing off both instruments in dialogue really well. And so you said something short, and I thought, hey, well, we could play this. And yeah, I just love the piece.
Well, let's listen. I'd like to learn about your violin. Tell me about your violin.
Well, it's an old Italian violin. It was made in 1754. Michele Decone is the name. He's a Venetian violinist, violin maker, I should say. I don't know a lot about his life, but I know that his instruments are respected, and it's a beautiful violin. It's got a dark sound. It's beautiful to look at. It's nice and old. I tell my children, it's 2 years older than when Mozart was born. That impressive thing. So most of the music I play, I mean, doesn't include Bach and Baroque music, but most of the music I play, you know, this violin has been around the whole time. That's kind of cool.
Catherine, I thought I'd conclude with you just by asking you to reflect on what music has meant to you growing up in such a musical household, a musical career. Music has been very good to you, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The life of a musician is not easy, and I've certainly had a good life. I know a lot of people have struggled a lot. But even successful musicians, we wonder why, you know, why we don't play more concerts, or why, you know, you don't have a better position, or make more money, or own a more expensive instrument. You know, there are all these whys. But the fact is that there are a lot of really good musicians out there, and there's only so much demand. And I have to just think that every day that I can get up and play or get up and teach is just, it's such a blessing that, you know, I don't dig ditches or something like that for a living, though I suppose that has its rewards too, out in the fresh air. But it really, I feel like I appreciate music more than maybe I did 10 years ago. When you're younger and you're out of college and you're worried about your career, you know, it's easy to just feel bad about the rat race that is classical music these days as a professional musician. But now that I'm getting older and I'm teaching more, I'm watching my children grow up, and I feel like, wow, this is a really good thing, playing and thinking about listening to music as the primary focus of my life.
Catherine Vodopek, a great joy meeting you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
A reminder that every day the music that you hear on our program is shared via Twitter. Just check out @KAR, Current State. It's there every day. And if you'd like to reach us via email, it's currentstate@wkar.org. Nice to have you back here on Monday. I'm Mark Bayshore. Exports are big business in Michigan. In 2012, $53 billion, or about 15% of the state's GDP, was attributed to the state's export economy, and that's up 12% just from 2011. Much of Michigan's exporting, however, is done by large corporations. Our next guest says there's vast room for growth among the state's small and medium-sized businesses, which often shy away from exporting due to the perceived complexities. J.D. Snyder is the project director for the Best Practices in Regional Export Strategies at MSU's Center for Community and Economic Development. Welcome, J.D.
Thank you, Mark. Pleasure to be here.
Give us a sense of the export market in Michigan right now.
Well, you just cited some really key data. Michigan's export activity has grown since the meltdown in 2008-2009. Michigan has enjoyed a strong export market relationship with our next-door neighbor, Canada. In 2012, we exported $25 billion worth of goods to Canada, which was over double the next exporting country partner, which is Mexico, and then the other three in the top five were China, Germany, and Saudi Arabia. So Michigan companies do have a good handle on exporting market activity and development, but we have a long, long way to go.
It would, and it's primarily larger companies. There's an opportunity here for the state to strengthen itself economically by getting more small and medium companies to participate.
Absolutely. And that's what we focused on in our project that started back in mid-2011, where we're working with regional partners across the state in working with their local economic development partners and small and mid-sized companies to show those companies the opportunities that exist for them to operate and thrive in foreign markets.
And why has it been so relatively underdeveloped?
Well, we're a big country in the United States, so it's real easy to think that by shipping to several states across the country that that's as good as it gets. And again, we're sort of insulated. It's just us and Canada and Mexico in the North American continent. So we don't have the kind of global access that other countries have in other parts of the world where they're surrounded by any number of different foreign countries. We have a very different historical, cultural experience in this country.
But there are also, I gather, real and perceived complexities involved in exporting to another country.
Well, certainly there are differences or complexities that are involved in shipping products and goods to foreign countries. First and foremost, you need to develop a relationship with these new customers that might be speaking a different language, a different legal system, and a different way of doing business. So there's a whole series of dimensions that in working with a foreign market and shipping and competing in a foreign market, you need to master a certain amount of new information and understanding that you didn't have to do if you were just shipping something down to Indiana.
That must translate into expense to some extent.
And to some extent, that's correct. But, if you're a company here in Michigan and you're shipping product to California, you need to fly out to California to build and maintain your customer relationship. There's expense involved in that, too. So the expenses, to me, are fairly modest in terms of being a part of an investment in market development that's going to reflect on on a positive impact on your bottom line.
What's been the impact of these recent efforts? There have been some pretty high-profile efforts that predate the Snyder administration. They go back to Jennifer Granholm. Some of these trips to foreign countries, our Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly's been to South America, et cetera. These are efforts all aimed at helping Well, to what extent are those efforts aimed at helping small and medium businesses in Michigan?
I think the state has done a good job in focusing on small and mid-sized companies because they understand and realize that in order for the Michigan economy to really grow and thrive, we need to cultivate these small and mid-sized businesses in a way that will contribute substantively to the overall state economy. So a lot of the growth that we can expect over the next few years is going to be growth in those small and mid-sized companies, and a lot of that growth is going to come from the development of export market.
There are both state and federal offices to aid businesses looking to export. Tell us about those.
Absolutely. We have a really wealthy menu of resources that are available to small and mid-sized companies. The state has its state trade and export program, the STEP program, and with that program, small and mid-sized companies can be reimbursed 50% of their export-related expenses up to a maximum of, I believe, $13,000. So, for example, a company that we met with a number of weeks ago applied for support from the STEP program, and that company is currently in Germany and some other European countries in visiting potential customers to develop export markets for their products. They're a company over in St. Clair County.
What business are they in?
They're in the medical technology business, so a good high-end niche market area. The other resources that are available to companies include the U.S. Export Assistance Center. There are offices both in Pontiac and Grand Rapids, depending on whether you're on the east side or west side of the state. The Export Assistance Center is a great place to start if you're thinking about shipping a product to a place that you haven't worked with before. And also, the Export Assistance Center will hook you up with the U.S. Commercial Service offices that have offices all around the globe, and that service will provide a company with contacts in a foreign country. They'll vet those contacts for your visit and really provide a tremendous value added. Any company that has used U.S. Commercial Services that I've communicated with, just go on and on and on about what a great service it's been for them, and it is a federal agency that's providing that service.
We're talking with J.D. Snyder today on Current State. J.D. is the project director of the for the Best Practices in Regional Export Strategies at MSU's Center for Community and Economic Development. Is there a particular sector of the Michigan economy that is, in your view, noticeably under-leveraged in terms of, agriculture, manufacturing? I mean, we think of agriculture and manufacturing first, but is there a sector that's overlooked here that really stands to benefit from greater exporting?
Well, I think the one sector that's really that's really neglected, perhaps, is the service sector. We don't often think in terms of the service sector being able, because it doesn't sell products, it doesn't sell goods, so you
right.
can't see it crossing the border.
How does that play out?
Well, one part of the service sector that sort of surprises folks is the fact that we have a very active tourism industry here. So that's, if you are bringing in foreign visitors to Michigan to take advantage of our cultural and natural resource attractions, that is a certain kind of service exporting.
But you're promoting tourism, you're kind of exporting promotion of Michigan. It's the Pure Michigan campaign or something like that.
Something
that you're talking
like that.
About?
Right, right.
That's too bad we can't export tourism, I guess. But I see what you're saying. The role China plays in this appears to be just huge. And in fact, in yesterday's Lansing State Journal Outlook section, there was some really compelling numbers here with regard to the role China plays as a recipient of Michigan products. Any comment on China in particular?
Well, it's a huge market.
It already is a huge market.
And it has huge potential. I mean, it has a huge rising middle class. It has, you know, probably a dozen cities of several million people. So it's a highly urbanized society. And with those urban developments, you have opportunities for infrastructure development. And we have a lot of companies in Michigan that can take advantage of those kinds of developments.
I noticed last night online that according to one very reputable looking website I was looking at, about 98% of German exporters are small and medium enterprises. In the United States, it's determined that only about 1%.
That's correct.
Export at all. If we're talking apples to apples here, that is an extraordinary discrepancy. What's going on there?
Germany has a long history of being a trade and export leader, and they've really, as a matter of state policy in that country, have really focused on small and mid-sized companies in a way that has been largely lacking in the United States up until very recently. When the president announced the National Exporting Initiative back in 2010, his major focus was we need to bring small and mid-sized companies into the exporting market because that's where the growth is.
Is there an insularity to American business still?
Probably far more than we would like to be the case. We're a large country. It's very easy to simply think about markets here in the United States and North America and think that's enough, and failing to realize that there's yet that much more out across the globe and they want to buy American products. And that's a really important thing to keep in mind, that folks in foreign countries want to buy American products. It's up to us to get those products to them.
J.D. Snyder is the Project Director for the Best Practices in Regional Export Strategies at MSU's Center for Community and Economic Development. Thanks, J.D., for joining us to discuss Michigan's export economy.
Thanks so much, Mark.
It's Current State on WKAR. Last week, the New York Times published a glowing story about MSU's new Broad Art Museum. At the same time, though, the piece seemed to take a swipe at the dining options available for out-of-town visitors here to East Lansing. And joining me this morning to talk about the story and what's up next at the Broad, Current State Scott Pohl. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Mark. How you doing?
Real good.
Good,
I was
good.
This story in the Times jumped out at me. I think it jumped out at all of us.
Yeah.
It was called A Mid-Michigan Museum Draws a Crowd. What are some of the high points in the story?
Well, the first thing that you notice is this beautiful photo of the Broad Art Museum. And by now, virtually everyone listening to us has seen the Broad, or at least seen a photo of the Broad. But for a national and international audience like you expect to be reading the New York Times, it's quite a striking, eye-opening photo of something that's in mid-Michigan. The text within the story, though, starts out with a reference to the North Campus area's classroom buildings and, quoting here, rundown frat houses. And it moves on to praise the Broad, though. It talks about the Zaha Hadid design, again, in their words, in the shape of a parallelogram that 73,000 people have visited since the museum opened 6 months ago, the pieces that they inherited from the Kresge Art Museum. To a potential visitor, the story makes the Broad seem to be well worth a trip to East Lansing.
Mm-hmm. You went over to the Broad Art Museum last week to learn about their newest exhibition.
Yeah, the new exhibition that opened last week is called Blind Field, and it features works from a group of young Brazilian artists. I talked with the museum's assistant curator, Yesomi Umolu, about Blind Field.
Actually, the way in which the exhibition curators, who are Tamela Masaka and Irene Small, kind of describe it is talking about a theory by the French philosopher Henri Lefebvre, where he describes a blind field. Now, this is in relation to kind of social economic theory, and he talks about the blind field being kind of the transitional zone between different socioeconomic eras. So if we think about the movement from an agrarian tradition to industrial context to kind of maybe what we have now, which is a more service-based urban industry, then he talks about the blind field being kind of like the space in which we transition from a past, which is like very quickly becoming obsolete, and a future which is rather unknown. So for him, this is the blind field where you lose some information from what came before, from between what came before and what is to come in the future. And he sees this, or the way in which the kind of the curators interpret this, is to think about the blind field and to think about a larger metaphor of blindness as being not kind of like a moment of being obscured from information, but a moment in which kind of you could take advantage of not seeing things in ways in which we are kind of conventionally positioned to see them. So there you think about blindness in terms of thinking about the way in which we understand the urban context, the way in which you understand economics, or in way in which you understand kind of day-to-day human experience. And you think about the blind field as being a possibility to rethink those kind of tenets of everyday experience.
How does that fit within the work of about 20 young artists from Brazil? Was this their thematic inspiration, or has it been designed to fit within the pieces that were chosen?
Well, I mean, there's an actual piece in the show called Blind Field, which is a kind of photographic piece. I'm not quite sure if the inspiration for that piece comes from Lefebvre's work, but certainly I think the concept is much more kind of the making of the curators who are thinking specifically about Brazil as kind of an emerging economy, as we like to call it, as somewhere that has obviously great historical significance and kind of great cultural capital, if we think about Latin America, but also as like a context which is going through a lot of kind of change and development. Now, obviously, Brazil is not unique in this. We think of places like China, or even we think back to the Industrial Revolution in Britain, or kind of the rise of kind of neoliberal capitalism in America. So they use it maybe as a bit of a site, as a bit of a kind of locale to think about this idea of socioeconomic change. They're thinking specifically about Brazil, about that context, but also thinking about wider kind of nation states. So they've kind of looked at the ways in which different artists are thinking about transition and transformation, whether across issues of aesthetics, or kind of how does one think about the relationship between art and politics. So they've kind of created this bucket or this concept of the blind field and kind of looked at different artists that might kind of fit into it or kind of offer different perspectives on it.
You mentioned photography. Are there other media involved in this exhibit?
Yeah, there's a range of media. I mean, as is customary with any contemporary art art installation these days, you have photography, you have sculpture, you have a wide gamut of video and audio-visual experiments. So those will be the main things. And there are a few paintings in there as well, just to think about other more traditional mediums, as it were. But it is really a mixed media show.
What is Brazil's place in the world of modern art? Is it growing? Is it inspiring young artists? We have about 20 in this exhibit. Where does Brazil fit in the bigger picture?
I mean, Brazil has a great heritage. If we think about specifically artists emerging in the 1960s and 70s, we think about the neoconcretism movement. We think about people like Cildo Morales and Elio Itisica. These are people who are kind of big names in the contemporary art world. So, I mean, definitely it's not emerging out of nowhere, and the tradition of contemporary art production has continued until the present day. And I think it still continues to be, specifically in Latin America, it still continues to be a center for artistic production. So you think of Rio as being like a great kind of meeting point for different artists. And obviously Sao Paulo, they have the Sao Paulo Biennial, which has a great tradition as well. So I mean, Brazil is definitely kind of a staple voice in contemporary art production.
What are one or two of the highlights of the Blind Field exhibition?
Well, yes, there are a few. They're definitely more than one or two, but ones that I wanted the audience to watch out for were the piece Blind Field by two artists called Cal Guimeras and Carolina Cordero. And actually, this is obviously where the exhibition name comes from, as well as Lefebvre's work. And they are two photographs, two diptychs, of kind of what looks like a conventional kind of like highway landscape. But when you look at them, you notice that the signage has been obscured by red mud or red dust. And they make quite kind of interesting kind of optical illusions. You're not quite sure what these kind of like red blocks of color are in the context of the canvas, as it were. But what's really interesting about that piece is kind of thinking about this idea of blindness and kind of obscuring meaning. So if we think about the highway and the signage that we see, those are things that kind of lead us in a particular direction. And by kind of pointing or kind of directing attention to kind of the kind of natural forces, accidental natural forces that obscure that, these two artists really kind of articulate this idea of kind of like an unexpected sort of sea change in which we have to then kind of adapt and be very kind of imaginative in responding to. So I think it's kind of a very interesting kind of piece to think about. Another very interesting piece is by a young artist, Jonathan De Adreded, who's actually getting a lot of international recognition. He was recently in the New Museum Triennial, and he's known specifically for kind of what we call excavating histories in some ways. So he looks back at kind of a number of archival sources and pulls images or documents from them and kind of uses it to tell a different history. So here in the case of this piece, which is called Tropical Hangover, he has taken a kind of a journal which kind of talks about a person's experience of 1970s in the town of Recife in Brazil, and he mixes that kind of account, this journal account, with archival images that he's kind of collected along the way. So you have images that look like tourist postcards, you have other ones that look at kind of like images of urban density, others that look like quite intimate portraits of families on the beach together. And so he kind of melds this kind of semi-fictional world together, where he's kind of revisioning the history of the city, which during the 70s had a lot of economic boom, but today, in recent times, has kind of like, as a lot of places around the world are experiencing, a kind of a big economic downturn. So here he talks about fact and fiction, and you think about blindness as well in terms of how histories are told.
The exhibit is called Blind Field. It will run at the Broad Art Museum at MSU until September 8th. Yesomi Umolu is the assistant curator at the Broad Art Museum at Michigan State University. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And many thanks for joining us today for Current State. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll talk with State Representative Sean McCann about his redistricting plan for Michigan legislative districts. We'll dig into a local archaeology project, and peer into the Lansing sewer system from a safe distance. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks as well to producer Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Yensia Wong for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan. FlukeHearing.com. And by the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce, hosting the annual Grub Crawl on Tuesday, June 11th, starting at 5 in the Eastwood Town Center. Details and wristbands available at LansingChamber.org.